Tango Tango Papa 1971, July 30, 2016.
Have we seen the actual reality of a monstrous crime? Or merely an illusion, the product of a tortured brain?
Good morning, good afternoon, good evening. Tom Wiles here with you, coming to you this evening from Columbus, Ohio. So I was home for several days. It would be this past week. Normally, I would have probably stayed out about a week to a week and a half longer than I did. Since the last time I was home. However, I had a dental cleaning appointment scheduled. That reminds me, I need to schedule another 3-month cleaning with the other dentist. I alternate between a periodontist and then my regular dentist for these cleanings. And so I need to reschedule my a cleaning appointment with the next one with the regular dentist, so I need to remember to do that. Anyway, I had that scheduled, and so I just went ahead, and they were able to get me home for it. I'd only been gone for maybe 2.5 weeks or so, but got home, took my time off, got my teeth cleaned. That seems to be working pretty well now. The last several times I've gotten, I kind of bounce back and forth between those two dentists every 3 months, and everything seems to be stabilized at this point. So that finally figured out between the 3-month cleanings periods, and then I finally figured out the a good method for cleaning my teeth in between, beyond just brushing and flossing, because you can brush and floss all day long, but that if you end up with a problem, that's not enough. And I've probably talked about it before, but I was able to get these sort of a dental cleaning in between your teeth product on Amazon. I don't remember exactly the name of what they're called. I'd have to actually look. But they have a little plastic handle, and it's they're at a 90 degree angle. They have this little wire that has the kind of a plastic thing on it, that it sort of reminds me of, you've seen pipe cleaners that end up being used in arts and craft type of people use those for arts and craft type things typically. So it's a piece of wire with a plastic, I don't know exactly what, sort of like a little plastic thing on there. And so this is sort of like a little tiny miniature version of that is thin enough to go in between teeth, and it kind of down at the gum line. And so I use these things to, after I brush and I floss normally, because I you want to do that at least once a day. Then I use this, I don't know, maybe it's called plackers or something like that. But the idea is that after I've brushed and flossed, then I can kind of go in at the gum line in between all the teeth that I can. I've got a couple of teeth that I can't do that because these two teeth are just too close together. The floss will go in there, but this placker thing won't do it. But but then, because it's at a 90 degree angle, then I can come in from the other way. So from outside in, and then inside out, and I do that on the bottom, both the bottom and the top, and that seems to have really made the big difference, because even with brushing and flossing, You know, you think, well, I'm getting all of the stuff that out of there I possibly can. Well, not quite, because this little placker thing, whatever the name of it is, actually, you know, it'll end up knocking. There's still some food debris in there. There's still some stuff in there, and the key to keeping your healthy gums is to get rid of the stuff that would help sort of set up a bacteria colony. And you know, human mouth is a very dirty place. You know, we like to think that we keep our mouths clean or whatever. No, I'm sorry, but they're an incredibly dirty place, and you know, it's just so. But anyway, you end up with a bacterial colony, and that's where all the problems kind of start. And so the idea with brushing and flossing and then using this placker thing is that it kind of breaks that colony up, and you want to do that at least once a day. And so I'm since I've been using this placker thing, whatever the name of it is, that may be the brand name, that really seems to have made the difference. And so I've been doing that for I don't know, quite a few months now, and so that's working. So anyway, I've got several voice comments that I'd probably need to get to. Otherwise, we're going to end up with a very long podcast, and I don't want to do that. Don't want to make this too long. So I'm trying to think. I guess we'll just jump right in. So I think we're going to start with a comment from Joel. So here is Joel.
Hey, Tom. It's Joel again. Listening to the early part of, I think it's your latest show. You're talking about travel trailers and your parents buying one, and you're thinking about possibly doing the same. The one thing I thought about doing is once my son is completely out of school, possibly, is selling my house. But before that, purchasing, you know, first off, fixing the house up. You know, there's some things that need fixed around here. But then before I completely sell the house, purchasing not a travel trailer, but an RV. And, you know, granted, a travel trailer might work too, but an RV or something like that. And then just rent a small apartment that we would go back to in Columbus, wherever my son's at, every once in a while, and have that as our mailing address. But then 90% of the time, traveling, because I want to go see the rest of the country. And to be honest, with the job that I have, I could do that. As long as I have internet connections, as long as I don't have to fly anywhere, then I can really go anywhere in the country and work, as long as I have good Wi-Fi connections. And it would have to be something very, very reliable, which that actually may end up being my problem, mostly because if I relied on 4G, then the bandwidth's not going to be sufficient over time. So, but it's something I've thought about. If not while I'm still working, definitely when I retire, you know, because there's no point in me having a big house with just me and my life. So, but I want to go see all of the states in our country. I'd like to go to Hawaii. I'd like to go to Alaska. Never been to either. I'd like to go to, well, I've never been to California. Never been to a lot of states, and I'd like to go through each one.
Okay, well, thank you, Joel. As you were talking, I've been watching a ton of YouTube videos about RVing, you know, people that are, you know, and that includes travel trailers. So you have travel trailers, and then you have two different types of travel trailers. You get the pole type that you have a ball, you know, kind of on, you know, on the, not really on your bumper, but attached to the frame of your vehicle. under the bumper, and then you have this ball, and the travel trailer has its tongue. That's one type of travel trailer, and then you have the fifth wheel type of travel trailer, where you mount a fifth wheel in the bed of your pickup truck. A lot of times it's a diesel pickup truck with a pickup truck with a diesel engine, and then you have this fifth wheel, and usually those are bigger, although there are some smaller ones. Typically those fifth wheels can be much bigger and much heavier, and they, you know, with all the slide outs and everything, they can get fairly heavy, and so you need a beefy engine in order to be able to pull that around. And then you have the motorhomes, and so you have the another type of travel, you know, you have a teardrop travel trailer, that's typically a little pull trailer, and then they increase in size and length and weight. But anyway, you go to the motorhomes, and you have the Class A's, and those are the kinds that look like a bus, where, you know, they're basically shaped like a bus. And then you have the Class C's, which that's sort of like a with a truck, and then the camper body stretched out behind it. And so the truck part is typically, a lot of times they use Fords. It's built on a Ford truck chassis, and you know, it's got the overhead bed that goes up over the cab. And so that would be a Type C. And then you have the Type B's, which, and I don't know who came up with the lettering scheme, but anyway, the Type B's are sort of a van conversion type of thing, where it's a smaller, and it's, you know, kind of a van type thing, where someone's taken maybe a large van and kind of converted it into a recreation vehicle you can actually live in. It's got a kitchen and a bathroom and a camp, you know, maybe some kind of a shower set up and what have you. And then you get into the sort of the B pluses, where you can they're actually tall enough where you can stand in them, and they're sort of bigger, but they're not quite as big as a regular Class C. So anyway, each one of them has their pros and their cons. But anyway, getting back to your comment, there are actually people that are doing what you're talking about. And so if you look up on YouTube, if you type in the name of their channel, that they call it The Freedom Theory. So if you just type in Freedom Theory into YouTube, into the YouTube search, they'll pop up. Their name is Josh and Callie. It's a husband and wife. And the husband is a network, what is he? He said he was a network engineer. And so he does all of his work from the RV remotely. So, and I think she may help him do some stuff. I'm not exactly, that's not really clear, but in any case, he is working, he has a full-time job doing networking, you know, whatever networking engineering type stuff that he does. And they're doing it, they've got a Verizon connection, I think, that they're using primarily. And so they're actually doing what you're proposing, what you're talking about. And so it is possible to do that. Right now, if you look, their latest videos, they're in Valdez, Alaska. And they said that they have a really good, solid, stable Verizon 4G signal to work from there. So that they're doing it. There's another husband and wife couple. The name of their channel on YouTube is what is it? Technomadia. So, you know, T-E-C-H-N-O, and then like nomad, but Technomadia. So it's T-E-C-H-N-O-M-A-D-I-A. Search for that and they'll pop up. And so both of them are working for, they have a bus conversion, so they have this 1961 Greyhound bus that was that they purchased from, that had already been converted into an RV. And so they have, and of course they've had to kind of renovate it, and they, I think more recently they had to have the motor rebuilt because it kind of crapped out on them. But they've been living in this bus. They've had other, you know, like travel trailers or whatever, but now they're living in this bus, and from 1961. Of course, they've got all kinds of solar panels and inverters, and each one of them has a kind of a workstation with their Macs, and so they're doing I don't know, they do some sort of programming for, you know, kind of medical related stuff, and they don't really talk about that. You know, deliberately they don't talk about what they actually do, other than just kind of, you know, that right there, that they do sort of custom programming for the medical industry, and that's about all they say about that, which that's wise on their part. But otherwise, they talk about their RV, kind of the RV lifestyle, and they have some, they do like live YouTube stuff, and so they're very, I don't know, I enjoy watching them, but they, you know, some people might consider them to be a bit boring, you know, because they really go to kind of in-depth into the RV stuff and people, you know, living full-time in RVs and what have you. So what you're talking about is quite doable. Now, and so there are people that have just absolutely, you know, if we're doing, you know, kind of doing what you're talking about. This one, I listened to some podcasts. I searched for some RV podcasts just by typing RV into, I'm using Pocket Casts, the Pocket Casts aggregator, and I typed in RV into that, and up came several podcasts, and so I'm kind of listening to them one at a time, the latest episodes. And in this one, they were interviewing this couple that they had, so they decided they were going to be doing this before they retired. They were about 6 years before they were getting ready to completely retire. They decided, well, what are we going to do? And they got this idea that they would just sell their house and get an RV and travel. And so what they've done in the meantime, they sold their house. And they downsized, they moved into an apartment, kind of a small apartment, and then they finally bought a motorhome, a new motorhome, and sort of kind of customized it, and, you know, where, you could, you know, because if you order one, depending on the manufacturer, they'll let you kind of customize things, and so I think it's Newmar is the... What was it? Newmar was the manufacturer, and so I guess that particular manufacturer will let you really customize stuff. Newmar Dutch Star or something like that. And so right now they've taken possession of as at the time of this interview, they'd taken possession of the RV. One of them had already retired, and the other one's retiring at the end of the year. And so that's kind of how and then so they're going to downsize more once they get out of the apartment and move into the RV and what have you. So, and then if you watch some of these videos, a lot of the people have done that. They've just sold their house and kind of just moved into the RV, and that's where they live. So, you know, there's a variety of ways of doing it. I don't know that I would sell my house, or I don't think I would do that. I think, let's be realistic, you know, I really don't want to do that. However, I think it would be fun to have some sort of a travel trailer, not necessarily a gigantic one, but maybe even a smaller one, because there's there's, if you, once you start researching this, there are just tons and tons and tons of manufacturers. There are more brands of trailers, and especially trailers, than you can shake a stick at. There's tons of them. So, you know, and each one of them is kind of, a lot of them have the similar floor plans, but each manufacturer sort of, you know, specializes in doing certain things in certain, you know, kind of a different way. And so I don't know. I'm still, you know, I've got plenty of time to decide. I did pay my house off a few, probably about a week ago. Just went ahead and made that last, I'd requested the payoff quote, and I made the last payment, and that's that. So no more house payment. Now I have, ooh, that was weird. Why'd that do that? Just lost, it came back. That was strange. I lost the left side of my headphone. How odd. But it came back. That's weird. Maybe the battery is getting weak. I have some other debt that I'm going to pay off, and I should be able to get rid of that pretty quickly. And after that, I plan to just save the money that I was spending on debt before, that I've been spending on debt up to this point. And that's the plan, and so we'll, you know, but in the meantime, I'm kind of looking and thinking about it, you know, because it's one thing to sort of theorize, you know, how would you use a space in an RV, what are your needs, etc., etc. That's one thing to theorize about it, and I think it's kind of another thing to actually do it. Now, you know, I think that I would like a, you know, some sort of an RV. If I was going to be in it very long at a time, I would like to have a real shower. And a lot of them, a lot of the travel trailers and the motorhomes now do have real showers, walk-in showers. Although you still, on, you know, because of necessity, on a lot of the like the tiny travel trailers, especially. In the really small motorhomes, then you get into what's called a wet bath, or you know, and so you have basically it's sort of like this, the size of a small shower, and it includes the toilet, and you know, everything gets wet, including the toilet itself, whenever you're taking the shower. And so that's, you know, I think I would prefer one that, it's kind of like I, you know, at home, I have, you know, a couple of bathtubs. One's a great big bathtub, and the other one's a normal size bathtub. The normal size bathtub has, you know, it's kind of like what you'd find in a motel with a shower above the bathtub with a shower curtain. But then in the other, in the master bedroom, the bathroom back there, it's got this giant bathtub that I very rarely use, plus a walk-in shower. And so I use the walk-in, when I'm home, that's what I use, is that walk-in shower. And I just find that a whole lot more convenient, just walk in the shower, close the door, and you know, and it doesn't make that much of a mess. And when I'm finished, I've got, you know, from the very beginning, I wipe the glass door down on the inside, because if you don't dry that glass door, then it's going to get all nasty and, you know, kind of lime stuff on it. And because I've always wiped it dry, it's fine. It never has collected any crap on it. Because some of those can get kind of nasty if people don't kind of keep up with them. So, but I prefer a walk-in shower. So, you know, there's a variety of ways you can go. The, of course, the advantage of a motorhome is that you just drive the thing off, and you don't have to worry about hooking up, you know, kind of coupling and uncoupling the vehicle. And then, of course, with a motorhome, you can also get a small car that you can tow behind it. You know, find one that's easily towable. You know, figure out how to, how to tow it. There's different vehicles that tow pretty easily, smaller, especially in smaller cars or whatever. And so a lot of people do that, and then whenever they get where they're going, then they can just disconnect the car and kind of travel locally or whatever. So there's a lot of people that are doing that now, and it's not just older people that are that are kind of living in RVs full time. There are a lot of younger people now that have kind of taken up the they've gotten this idea and they've sort of taken up the lifestyle, and there's a lot of them that are on YouTube that have their YouTube channels, and so it's kind of an interesting thing that's happening. And a lot, there's even families, the families, because they're traveling in different parts of the country all the time, they're actually doing homeschooling. And some of this one podcast I was listening to this evening, the guy said, well, what's the largest family that you know of that's doing this? And he said, well, there's this one family we know about, they have 13 kids with one on the way, so it's, that's crazy, but it can be done. So, anyway, thank you, Joel, for the comment. So, I think next we're going to hear from Jeremy. So, here is Jeremy.
Hey, Tom, it's Jeremy. Just checking in real quick since I was on my commute and I was thinking about something. I'm listening to a podcast where they're talking about dimensional stuff, like interdimensional things. And I know I asked you about time travel. And I think that, it's a very good possibility that that's not even physically possible. Although, there are arguments for it, I suppose, theoretical arguments for it. But I was actually thinking about infinity. And I was wondering, as a scientific concept, like when we do math and we have like a decimal and then there's no end to the decimal, like, or to the value after the decimal, like, 3, 3, 3, 3, 3, like if you keep doing this, it's just going to go on forever. And that's infinity. But the reality is that it's still, you're representing, that number represents something physical in many cases, like, or it doesn't. I mean, in theoretical math, I'm trying to think of a way to say this where it makes sense. Like, if we're talking about theoretical math, infinity is something that, yes, if you kept writing, you would have to keep writing forever. But does infinity go both ways? In other words, does infinity even apply when there's an origin for something? So if there's a starting point, then you can't consider anything about that to be infinite, right? Because it wasn't always there. So infinity as a concept, I was having trouble imagining that the universe itself, like people talk about the infinite universe. And of course you could say that because nobody's ever seen the edge of the universe or nobody's ever been there.
Okay, well, let me interrupt. This is it's an interesting thing to think about infinity. And you're talking about, well, if something has a, like mathematically, something has a starting point, but not really, because then you get into the concept of negative numbers, and of course, that goes off into infinity. Now, when you get into the real physical objects, and of course, they like to say, well, the universe has a beginning, which it must have had some kind of a beginning, because there is no physical equivalent, at least that I can conceptualize of where you'd have a negative infinity, negative physical infinity. That's kind of a meaningless idea or concept, but the universe obviously had some sort of beginning. Now they want to say, well, it's a big bang or whatever, and you had this infinitely hot small dot, you know, that suddenly just exploded. And I think that's gobbledygook, personally. But whatever the beginning, I think, you know, it goes on forever. So, you know, how can you have something that goes on forever? Now, it kind of depends on, you know, you have the idea there is a beginning, so therefore that means that there's a beginner. We didn't create ourselves. We didn't originate ourselves, and we didn't originate the universe that we find ourselves in. So the concept of infinity, you think, well, how can space and time go on forever? And of course, space and time are really the same thing. It's kind of hard to really wrap your mind around, but they are really this one and the same thing. We sort of maybe perceive them as being separate elements. We think of space as something that's kind of three-dimensional that we move around in, and we think of time as a, you know, kind of an abstract thing that passes from one moment to the next. But the space and time really are one and the same thing. So what creates space and time? So I don't know. It's been a while back. I read the entire book. Roy Masters has this book called, you know, it's the original. It was called Finding God in Physics. And I read the whole thing chapter by chapter. Now, the concept is that, you have this thing that we think of as, sort of an ethereal thing called gravity. And the idea is that gravity is, it's able to kind of pass through itself. It's, the energy is full of whatever this thing is that's gravity, and it's coming with such force and such violence from, let's say there's a singularity that this thing is coming out of. It's coming out with such force that it actually is at where it's causing spins, and where it intersects with itself and it causes these spins, that ends up spinning out little particles we know of as the building blocks of matter. And so if you can kind of, another way of thinking about it is sort of the radar arm going around and around on a screen, and it sort of renews the image. And so if you can imagine that this gravity is coming from every direction, it's able to, it travels right through itself, except where there are little, you can think of them as little grid points where it creates these spins that end up kind of giving birth to the building blocks of matter, ultimately giving birth to matter. So all of this is happening, and we perceive it as being just, matter is very stable and it's solid and so on and so forth. But we know that, on the very elemental levels of matter, it's really the solidity of it is kind of an illusion. It's more of a, it's forces. Matter is sort of made up of forces, and there's really nothing solid about it. It's full of empty space. And but if you can imagine something kind of going in a circle, like a wind that's causing, if this wind that sort of, this gravity wind that sort of is coming from every direction at once, that is able to sort of create an infinity. You know, if you can imagine something going in a circle, the circle is infinity. The circle is infinite. And so therefore, it's not that much of a stretch to imagine that whatever it is, you know, from whatever other dimension, that this gravitation, this force that's coming, whatever it is that's gravity, it's sort of an ethereal thing, it's coming into this dimension from some other dimension that we know nothing about. And I don't think, you know, we probably really can't ever know too much about it. But it's sort of giving birth to the physical universe in which we find ourselves. Then, therefore, that through that process, it's able to, it is infinity. And so, therefore, that's how infinity can kind of exist. It can't really exist without a beginning. You have to have a beginning, and then you have to have that beginner. And then we can't, of course, that's God, and, you know, we can't imagine, we can try to imagine what God, you know, of course, we want to be God ourselves from a kind of a will standpoint, and of course, we can't. I won't go into the whole philosophy and theology of that, because if you've listened to me very long, then you're probably pretty well familiar with it. But so we can't imagine, where did God come from? How did He come to be, etc., etc.? Hard to fathom. But we are the creation, and it's pretty obvious that we are the creation. And so as long as there's a creator kind of giving birth to the creation, then the creation, I really think, is infinite. As, you know, the creation is as infinite as the creator. And it's pretty obvious that the creator is infinite. So, but we have a hard time with these concepts because we kind of come into existence and go out of existence. And it's hard for us to kind of wrap our minds around the idea that something can go on forever. But it's helpful to understand that, one of the ways you can understand infinity is a circle, because a circle is infinity. It goes on, it just goes around and around and around, but it's, it really is a way of kind of understanding what infinity is. So yeah, I could go on talking for a long time, but I better shut up. And so here's the rest of Jeremy's comments.
But is it even likely that there is an infinite universe? Because it seems to me that infinity as a concept, I have a rough time understanding it. Well, of course, we're humans, so how can we understand infinity? But even as a scientific principle, infinity doesn't make sense. I might sound like a rambling idiot right now, but I'm trying to just throw something out there, and maybe you've thought about it, or you come across other people talking about it. If something has an origin, then there was a point where it began, and therefore it's not infinite because it wasn't before. So then the only real infinite thing would be something that has always existed, something that came before, but never did not exist. So I guess that's what when people talk about God, they talk about this infinite being who always has been and always will be. And it's pretty well just, it's mind-blowing to consider. But I wasn't sure if it was something that you would have come across in your readings or your discussions. And, it's certainly probably something that I shouldn't be thinking about because my little mind can't comprehend it. And so I get to that does not compute stage, and then, I just kind of have to quit before my head starts hurting. I just wanted to throw that out there for food for thought or discussion, and hope that you understand it more clearly than I do. Thanks, Tom. Check in soon. Take care.
Okay, well, thank you, Jeremy. Jeremy is actually, there's actually two Voxer comments, so that was the first one. Have you ever tried to think about, you know, what is nothing? You know, if the universe, if there was no existence, if there was no universe, if there was no human consciousness to be kind of aware of it, what would nothing be? You know, would it be empty? Because is space nothing? You know, and if you really think about it, space has properties. So therefore, because you know, it's not just empty, you know, empty space, you know, and obviously there's a speed limit. Space has got a speed limit. Physical speed limit is 186, 186 million miles per, yeah, whatever it is. The speed of light, 186,000 miles per second, I think is what it is. Maybe I need to look that up. 186,000 miles per second. I'm pretty sure that's what it is. So it has a speed limit. So it's not just empty space. There's something else is going on there. And by the way, Roy Masters' theory sort of neatly explains that, because you've got these, if you imagine you've got these two, or you've got this force that's kind of coming from every direction, you know, and when it's it sort of mostly passes through itself, but then if you have a piece of matter that's sort of spun out of it, that matter can only go so fast, you know, like the little light, you know, wavicle, you know, is it a wave or is it a particle? It's got properties of both, so it's a wavicle. It can only go so fast, and then it's got this opposing force that is kind of acting as a speed limit, so that it can only go so fast. Even if it's traveling in a perfectly straight line and it's there's almost nothing to it, yet even it has a speed limit. So, but space has got a speed limit, so it's got properties, and so therefore it's not nothing. So you can't think of nothing existing as just being empty space, because space itself is not, you know, it wouldn't exist either. If there was nothing, if there was literally nothing, and we have a hard time trying to imagine what nothing would be. You know, and the wording that the Bible uses in the book of Genesis, at least the translated version, you know, translated into English, you know, God, or the forces, or God moved, how's it worded, something, the you know, talks about the void, you know, the moving across the face of the deep, and it talks about the void. What is the void? You know, what would the void be? You know, so something was there, you know, or what would a void, you know, would a void be nothing? You know, and we can't, as I say, we have a hard time, if you think about it, we have a really difficult time thinking of what nothing would be. Now, no thing, you know, not really a play on words, but two different. If there is no thing there, that's one thing, but nothing, just absolutely nothing, we have a really tough time, if you really think about it, trying to even conceptualize that. So, love thinking about these things because they, you know, it really is fascinating. But space itself is not just—it's not just empty nothingness, because space itself is actually just as searching for a word. It's just as real, and it's just as much of a creation as human beings are. It really is. So space itself is also creation, and it's got its properties. So Anyway, let's get to Jeremy's second comment. So once again, here's Jeremy.
Hey, Tom. Jeremy here. Sorry, I didn't leave very much space in between messages, but trying to keep these short to digestible chunks. But something I've never heard you talk about is, the afterlife. I was wondering if you believe in an afterlife, if you believe there's life after death. You talk a lot about the Bible and Creator and all of that. And I was curious as to your thoughts about that part of the Christian philosophy, or if you care about that part of it at all. And one of the things I think is funny is that people like my mom is very religious. Well, both my parents are fairly religious. But one of the things Christians tend to believe in is an afterlife, like a place in heaven after death. But they'll also, actually mock people who believe in reincarnation, which is really just the belief in past lives. Well, if you believe in an afterlife, that means you believe in reincarnation in some form, right? You believe in multiple lives. You believe in this life of the present, and you believe there's a life after this. So I don't see that as that much more crazy than the idea that there's an afterlife after this one. So that would mean that there are multiple lives, which, again, not that much of a departure. So just curious on your thoughts on that topic. I've never heard you discuss that angle before, so I'm curious as to your thoughts on that and maybe some supporting thoughts or feelings around it. All right, Tom, stay safe out there. I'll check in soon. Bye.
Okay, well, thank you again, Jeremy. The Bible itself says that, eye hath not seen, nor ears heard what the Lord thy God has prepared for those that love him. Is basically, that's probably a little bit of a paraphrase because I can't quote it exactly. So we don't know. When it comes right down to it, we as human beings don't know what lies beyond, sort of our death as a physical creature. Now, that being said, you get into the idea, what is consciousness? And you'll have people that argue, well, consciousness is just something that the brain, it's just a sort of an illusion that the brain creates, and it doesn't really exist. But then if you look at the people that are doing like the double slit experiment and that type of thing, consciousness, it becomes obvious that consciousness ends up affecting the experimental results. And I won't go into all of that, but there's plenty of material that you can go into, where they talk about consciousness and the double slit experiment. So what is consciousness? So, then you can study the brain, and there's plenty of people that are studying the brain, and they're sort of finding out that it really does have some more or less robotic aspects to it, and there are people that are trying to hack it one way or the other, and they're trying to figure out how the brain operates, and it's very complicated, obviously, and they haven't figured out very much of it, relatively speaking, but it is a mechanical thing. But that still doesn't answer what is consciousness, and there are people that obviously believe that a computer, that man should be able to build a computer that should, that consciousness, Ray Kurzweil keeps saying that consciousness is an emergent property. After you get a complicated enough system, then consciousness is an emergent property, so's a tooth fairy. I don't believe that. I don't think it just emerges from a complicated system. I think that's gobbledygook. So I think consciousness, my own personal belief is that consciousness, whatever that is some other element that we as human beings are sort of endowed with, and that sort of interface that ends up interfacing with our brains, which are basically their physical computers, very sophisticated biological computers, just unimaginably sophisticated, yet they're still physical computers. So, but there's this element of consciousness, this awareness, is my personal belief is that that is that's some other element that we as human beings cannot, you know, we can kind of reproduce it biologically, but we cannot, I don't think that we're ever going to be able to make a machine that's conscious. I think that's a silly idea. So I do believe that there is a part of us, you know, you want to call it consciousness or soul, I think that does survive. That's not, because you have, you know, you have a physical body, but then there's this other part of us that's, you know, it's kind of ethereal. So the thing is, we don't know what lies beyond. You know, and I've never, you know, the problem with, you know, the idea, well, you know, people have this idea of reincarnation. And in some cultures, you know, like you look at the Indian culture, you know, people from India, the Indian culture, that they've got this whole thing, you know, this whole religious system, and they all kind of believe that maybe, you know, if you get punished, you're a cow or whatever, your cows or, you know, your ancestors come back as cows or something or other. I don't know exactly what it is, but anyway, they sort of won't, that's one of the reasons they, you know, they won't eat cows, is because they're afraid they're going to be eating, you know, it's cannibalism or something. I'm not, not really that well versed on it, but, you know, it's, the problem with that is that, you know, it's, you know, kind of an interesting idea or interesting theory, but then they have it kind of crammed down their throats. You know, you're born into the Indian culture, and that you have that sort of, that belief system is sort of crammed down your throat, whether you like it or not. And people do absorb the culture around them, whether they like it or not. So, as an idea, just kind of setting all that aside, as an idea, interesting idea, I don't, you know, really subscribe to it. We have what we have. We're here. We're conscious right now. And that's where, you know, from the way I look at it, if I'm going to make the most of my existence, if I really want to find my creator, am I going to find him, you know, kind of dreaming about the past, or, you know, what might have happened in the past, or what might happen in the future? No. You have to look for your creator, because all we have is, you know, as conscious creatures, we have the present moment to be conscious in. And that's where our creator is. And that's the only place that we're going to be able to find him, that we can really make contact, or allow him to make contact with us, is in the present moment. And so that's what we have to be conscious of, is the present moment. Learn to be conscious in the present moment. Make friends with what you think of as a guilty conscience. Make friends with whatever that is, but it has to be in the present moment. It can't be thinking about, you know, some dream world of the past or whatever, or some dream world, imagined dream world of the future. It is in the present moment. And that's really where it's at. So who knows what lies beyond, you know, not to worry. Not to worry, because if you can, what I've found personally is that if I can really kind of stay in the present moment, then the future kind of takes care of itself. I don't, you know, I don't really need to worry about it. Now, obviously I need to eat and I need to work and I need to pay my bills and that type of thing. But at the same time, it's kind of, you know, you may think it's kind of paradoxical. I really don't worry about what happens in the future. I really don't worry about it at all. It's really paradoxical. You know, if you kind of look at it from a sort of an outside looking in perspective, that seems silly. You think, oh, you better be worried about, look at all these things that are happening in the world, et cetera, et cetera. And, you know, I keep hearing all these people talk about how horrible 2016 has been, and it's just been just really rotten, and they're all depressed over it. Even in, you know, these different podcasts that I listen to, you know, sometimes they end up talking about how horrible 2016 has been. Well, you know, it, you know, I'm looking and I see it and it's there, but it's almost like it, you know, I'm kind of have a distance from it. Really do have a distance from it, even though it's there and it's happening to people. But it's kind of a paradox. But if what I've found is if I can really, you know, if I can really stay in the moment, then that's where God is in the moment. And it's not some woo-woo kind of mystical thing. I know you have some people that want to make fun of that. Well, you know, laugh it up. Have at it. You know, the acid test is how, you know, how well are you able to stay in the present moment? You know, how, you know, what anxiety level do you have? How's your anxiety? How's that anxiety working out for you? What anxiety level do you have? And that will tell you, and, you know, only you are in your own head, that will tell you, you know, what kind of an anxiety level do you have, sort of tells you where you're at as far as being able to remain in the present moment. So, but that, we don't know what lies beyond. And I, you know, I don't speculate about it. We don't know. And I did not create myself. And so therefore, you know, I can't, and if when I try to recreate myself, it ends in disaster and it ends in me, you know, with, you know, high anxiety. So, you know, it's easier just to live in the present moment. You know, the past is the past, but if you can live in the present moment and be aware in the present moment, then, you know, the future really kind of does take care of itself. And, you know, we really don't know. We're in the experiment. We're not doing the experiment. We're subjects in the experiment. And beyond that, can't really say much. So, anyway, thank you, Jeremy. So, we've heard from Joel, and we've heard from Jeremy. And so, I've got a short comment here from Michael Moss. So, here is Michael.
Hey, Tom, a little feedback here for the show. More of an opinion. Let's see what you think. Do you think our political elections would be better served if people actually voted for issues instead of simply voting to stay behind party lines? What do you think?
Okay, well, thank you, Michael. So the question is, Michael's question is, would it be better if people voted for issues, I guess, as opposed to, or, you know, the way he put it, being behind party lines? If it's just issues, no, that's not going to fix it. Our problems are, you know, kind of go beyond that. You know, issues are only go so far. You know, why we're, one of the reasons why we're in big trouble is because we have gone into the moral abyss. We've gone over the cliff. And we've really kind of done that, or a huge chunk of our society has done that, has gone right into the sewer. And so therefore, it doesn't really, you know, politics sort of ends up arising out of the decay of morality, if you want to think of it that way. Politics kind of arises out of that, and then you have this war, the politics, the left and the right. What is that? It is the war between, it's an ancient war between Adam and Eve. It's an ancient war between men and women. The women are kind of, you know, kind of the female women type things on the left, and the male thing is on the right. And so that's the really where, what is happening. It's a war. It's a family war that's going on. And so the politics arises, you know, kind of en masse out of this it's a familial war that is happening. Family war. If you have you know, if you can imagine all of the things that can go wrong in a so-called nuclear family, those scale up and that turns into politics. And so then it's, you know, so just if you want to really understand what can happen politically, then, you know, the best way to understand it is to scale it back down to what goes on, what are the family dynamics, what goes on in, you know, a nuclear family. And, you know, so then you have the problem, you know, of in a family unit, if let's say there's a family argument, there's an argument between mom and dad, and you kind of throw the kids in there to add stress, who's going to win the argument? Do the kids benefit from the argument? Some of the kids side with mom and some of the kids side with dad, you know, depending on how many kids there are. Excuse me. So, you know, then you can begin to, you know, say, well, we're not going to argue about, you know, whose side. We're just going to argue issues, you know, whatever those issues are. And the real problem, you know, once that scales up and it becomes political, people, especially people that have lost their connection, maybe they never did find it really with their creator, of necessity end up becoming emotional. And, you know, and it's emotionally driven. And then so some of the kids side with mom and so the other kids side with dad. And they're all emotional about it. And so, this, you know, so that scale that up, that becomes Republicans and Democrats, you know, at least in the United States. Conservatives and liberals. And so there is no solution. Politics is an extension of a problem. It's just, it arises out of the decay of the so-called nuclear family. And the more dysfunctional the family becomes, the more dysfunctional the family unit becomes, the worse the problem is. And there is no solution to it. You know, and eventually people are strangling each other. They kill each other. So, you know, throw the politics part out. You can't, you know, I've tried just talking issues, you know, just from a political issue standpoint. I've tried just talking, you know, my parents, especially my mom, is, you know, tends to be pretty liberal. She's, you know, both parents tend to, you know, kind of think of themselves as Democrats. Of course, they were, you know, they came from an age when, you know, like the, my mom was born in, what year, 1925? Dad was born in, now let me think, I gotta get this straight. Dad was born in 1937, Mom was born in 1925. So Mom is 91 years old, Dad now is 82. And so they come from a time, you know, the 20s and the 30s, they were, you know, kind of raised in the 30s and 40s. They come from a time when, you know, things were probably very different than we know of them today, you know, or that, or at least they were very different than when I was raised. I was, you know, really, you know, of course, I was born in 1955 and probably never really became conscious of my own existence, at least to where I can remember. I can remember maybe as early as age two, but probably not much, you know, I can kind of remember being kind of age five and up. So I really am more aware of the 1960s. That's when I really kind of became aware of my own existence. But they were born in, you know, kind of raised in a different time. And so, you know, but be that as it, you know, whether you had different propaganda. And but be that as it may, I've tried and tried and tried and tried and tried endlessly, it seems, to talk, you know, instead of talking politics, just kind of talk about the logic of what, you know, what would work and what doesn't work. And you can make all the logical arguments in the world and it doesn't matter. You know, they're gonna think the Democratic way and you know, kind of, you know, and that's that. However, I've stopped that, you know, probably a year and a half ago or maybe 2 years ago, maybe not quite that long ago. I stopped it. I won't argue with them politically anymore. I just quit. I've given up. And it's probably started about the time that I realized that there is no political solution. And so I stopped. I won't argue politics with anybody anymore. And I won't argue issues really with anybody. You know, very, very little. What I will talk about is morals. And they agree with me. My parents actually agree with me that the morals have gone into the sewer. And a lot of people that would normally, that would argue politics, you know, kind of will agree, I find, that, you know, that they, you know, that the morals are really in the toilet. And that's really the root of our problem, and there really is no political solution, you know, as a result. So, you know, and I found some people that will kind of agree with me that there, you know, yeah, it is a moral problem. But then they think somehow we're going to fix this moral problem if we just get the right leader in there and they follow the Constitution, blah, blah, blah. Ain't going to happen that way. Not going to happen that way. The only way that people begin to become conscious is through suffering. You got to suffer. And that's, and even suffering is no guarantee that you're going to become, that you're going to become conscious, that you're really going to start looking for real answers. Because some people, as I've said before, some people are just happy to kind of die in the gutter and take as many people with them as they can. Misery loves company. But you have some people that they get to a point where they've sort of hit the bottom and there's no place else to go. They've tried everything, and then they all of a sudden they become conscious and they start thinking rational thoughts. And so that really is the only thing, if anything, is going to kind of cause you or cause anyone to turn around and kind of really start to want to become conscious, truly conscious, suffering is the thing that, you know, that's it. That's where it's at. And so you can't cause people to want to change. You can't talk somebody into it. Not going to happen. All you can do is kind of find the ones that are sort of ready. And that's really a hard thing to judge. So therefore, it's best just to, you know, kind of talk to people. And you can't really the only way I've found, you know, I can't really predict who's going to, you know, just by looking at somebody who would respond and who wouldn't. The only way that it works is if I treat everybody the same, and some people are probably put off by what I have to say, and I can tell pretty quick if they are. But some people will, you know, just instantly respond to it. And so there's really no way of looking on the outside to know what's on the inside, per se. So I'm sure there are little signs that you could probably look for, but it's kind of a really, really difficult thing to predict who's going to respond and who isn't. But suffering is the only thing that can really cause that to change. And so you have, at this point, you've got more people, at least, you know, worldwide, but certainly in America, there are more people suffering. And I'm afraid that it's probably going to have to get worse for a lot of people. And that's just the way it is. So it's really a mistake to try to, you know, prevent someone from having to suffer, to kind of take their suffering away from them. That's basically what parents do when they spoil their kids. Excuse me. Oh yeah, I think I got a battery problem with my, I need to replace the battery here in my, this Bose headset that I have. Because it's acting goofy right now. So anyway, thank you, Michael, for the comment. And so now, the final comment we have is going to be from Scott. So here is Scott.
Hello, Tom. Listening to the latest podcast at this point in time, I got three of them to listen to. I'm going to work my way backwards. But you're taking a comment from Joel McLaughlin, and he's talking about... you're talking about Elon Musk and us living in a simulated universe, and how babies have to have somebody nurture them, and so on. And I believe all this is meant basically as a proof that God had to exist. You know, I preface this by saying, as I always say, that I am a believer, not a non-believer. I'm not an atheist, but I'm also not biblical. And Tom, you're in that same camp, because you kind of said that. So that being the case, we're on the same team, if you will. But here's something I'd like to hear bantered around, because I've never gone to giving anybody when they want me to prove God exists. I refuse to do it because I try to tell them that it can't be proven. There is no science. There is nothing I can say to prove God's existence. And so when I hear other people doing it, I look that over and say, does it really make any sense at all? I accept God on faith because I want to, not because I can prove it. That's that. But the God I accept has to be logical, and the God I accept has to be loving. Because if he's hateful or illogical, I don't have a chance of understanding him. Anyway, that stated, people will say things like, you know, children have to have somebody nurture them. So how we had to have somebody nurture us, or all of this is just too complicated to have just happened by accident. It demands a creator. Things this complicated don't just happen. They demand a creator. Well, if that logic is entirely acceptable to you, then it screams out for this question, and that is, okay, poof, God exists. Who created God? Because obviously if we're so incredibly complicated that nothing could have ever created this except a God must therefore be all that more complicated and ipso facto also demands a creator. What was before God? And why? And what and whom or whatever created God? And if and whatever the answer to that is, why wouldn't it work without God even being there for all of existence that currently is? Because I hear people say, well, he's always existed. Okay, well, why can't this have always existed? You know, well, you know, it doesn't require us to know that. Well, then why do we require to know that? I mean, whatever answer you give, why wouldn't that answer apply to this without even involving a God? This is devil's advocate, I know, but that's why I find that argument to be kind of specious, I guess. Kind of, you know, when you really follow it through, it doesn't make sense. Why would you give God a pass on the very critique or criteria that you're not giving reality a pass on? The reality is so complicated that it had to have been that there was something that created it. It couldn't have just happened. Well, whatever created it is that much more complicated, and it demands the same question be answered, in my opinion. Why would you not answer that same question? And that's it. I would love to hear you, Joel, and anybody else who cares to pop in on it, discuss that question. And that is not, as I said, meant to dissuade anybody from being a believer, because I am. I am not an atheist. But I've never begun to use that as any kind of an excuse for my beliefs, because it's, to me, it seems like it's indefensible. So there you go. I only say my faith, and this drives atheists crazy, because when they try to tear apart the Bible and I'm not biblical, and they try to tear apart, you know, various logical arguments to tear apart God, and I say, look, this isn't based on logic. And at that point, they're out of gas. When I admit to them, it's based purely on faith, and I'm not going to defend it. I don't need to defend it, you know, and that's all there is to it. And it drives them nuts. Catch you later.
Okay, so what you do, you tell people, if someone asks you who created God, you just simply tell them, well, God evolved. And that kind of nixes the thing just as well, I think. Because if they're willing to believe that we evolved, then, you know, obviously God evolved, you know, so that, you know, they can't, in other words, if they're willing to believe that we evolved and that the universe just sort of, it just kind of happened somehow, and life arose on planet Earth, and, you know, it's just all these special circumstances happened, which doesn't really work with the law of averages, by the way, you know, if they're willing to believe that, then why are they not willing to believe that God evolved? You know, so, and we will never know, because God is in, we're the creation, God is in, you know, there's some other dimension that we can't go to. And, you know, so, God evolved. Try that, see how they respond to that. And then when they respond negatively to that, point out to them that, you're willing to believe that we evolved, but why can't God evolve? You know, you're contradicting yourself. Now, the problem that we have as human beings is we are the creation. And so, and I've used this example before. Imagine, you know, that you're a cup, a clay cup. What could you as a clay cup know of or be aware of the creator that created you? you know, you couldn't. You would just, you know, and in this example, we have to imagine that the cup is aware, and it's sort of aware of its own existence. It wouldn't know. Maybe it could kind of feel the hand sort of shaping it as a piece of clay, but, you know, maybe it could feel the heat while it was baking, but, or maybe somebody washing it or something. But other than that, you know, to kind of extend the analogy, other than that, what could the cup know of its creator? Not much, other than, you know, maybe it felt itself being shaped or whatever as a piece of clay. So, but human beings are not clay cups. And if you think about it, whatever we are as human beings, as I was speaking before, we have this awareness. We're aware of our own existence. And depending on how, you know, some people maybe are more aware than others, I, as a human being, am keenly aware of my own existence. The question of, you know, where did I come from? Why am I here? Why do I exist? That's always been with me from as the earliest ages that I can remember. Especially, once I really kind of became conscious of my own existence, probably, past age 5, you know, sometime in the 1960s, I really kind of became conscious at some point of my own existence. And that question has always been with me. Once I was aware of my own existence, I was wondering, why do I exist? And I found an answer to that. Can I prove that to you? I can try to lead you to it. I can try to lead you to it, but you got to find the answer yourself. Now, for me, I can tell you this, just accepting something on faith, you know, well, God, you know, God must exist because I'll believe that he does, and I'm going to just use these words because I've heard a preacher say them. Just accept Jesus on faith and it takes all your sins away, blah, blah, blah. Those are just words. And they're probably words out of a mouth that they're coming out of the wrong mouth. A mouth that they don't have the right meaning. So I can't accept that. I can't accept it. Someone says, yeah, well, just take it on faith. Just take it on faith that whatever. That's empty. That's meaningless. I want the real meaning. I have to have the real meaning. I have to understand these things for myself. I can't just accept something because somebody said so. You know, whether it's, you know, a preacher or some sort of scientific expert, I can't accept something just because somebody said so and we all believe that way and what have you. We've had this argument before. And I'm sure we'll have it again. So, but when it comes right down to it, I have to, you know, and I can only really speak for myself, I have to be able to find, you know that my Creator exists. And I do. And it's not a matter of faith at this point. I know. And, you know, I know that's just words to you. It's just words coming across to you in a recording. So that's as far as I can go. I can't, I can try to lead you to the right state of mind, or hopefully you're already in the right state of mind and you're either really looking or you're not. And if you're really looking, I can help you maybe a little bit. But if you're really not looking and you're just, you know, kind of browsing around, and maybe you think, well, I'll just say that, you know, I'll just uh, some people will just say that they believe in God and maybe go to church a little bit or whatever, or they'll just say that they believe and that they pray or whatever, but it's just sort of based on words, you know, and that's not good enough, you know, at least the way I look at it. It was not good enough for me. I have to be able to experience. And that's a subjective thing. I can't prove, you know, I can't prove to you that any of this. Of course not. It's not provable. So, at the same time, what really is provable? Can you prove there is no God? No, you can't. So, what it really comes down to, as I said before, you know, you're not going to get anywhere arguing. You know, you can argue until you're blue in the face, and it's still going to be, you know, unless you're able to really find it for yourself, you're able to really find your Creator, then arguing about it is, you're wasting your breath. You really are wasting your breath. You're wasting your time trying to argue one way or the other, or get somebody to, you know, try to explain it to you. You think you've got them kind of trapped in a corner somehow, and you're trying to get them to explain something to you. Can't be done. So, you know, but you're really wasting your time. If you're, you know, you've got to find this yourself, and this just doesn't apply to you. It applies to everybody. You know, and it's a dangerous thing to think that you've arrived. You know, there's plenty of people that think that they're there, that they have arrived. You know, they've been going to church for years, and they know, you know, they've heard thousands of preacher sermons and what have you, and they think they're there. And that's a dangerous thing to think that you're there. That's a dangerous thing to think that you know it all and that there's nothing else left. So the only thing you can really do, as I said before, is be aware, keenly aware, in the present moment. That's all there is. That's really, when it comes right down to it, that's all we have as human beings, is this present moment. Now, one moment passes into the next, but that's all we have. And that, if you can get rid of the distractions, etc., etc., then God is in the present moment. But you're going to have to prove it to yourself. I can't do it for you. Joel can't do it for you. Or vice versa. So, anyway, thank you, Scott, for the comment. I've got a bunch more comments from Scott, and so we'll just have to... what I'm going to do is just kind of, every time I record a podcast, include one or two of his comments in there, and eventually we'll get through them. So anyway, think I better be cutting this off, because we're probably at least an hour and a half by now. Hope everyone is having a great weekend. Hope you have a great week coming up, and I will catch you later.
Remember, Trucker Tom is like Visa. He's everywhere you want to be.
Product reviews, restaurant reviews, photos, opinions, and more. Visit Trucker Tom's website at www.truckerphoto.com. You've been listening to Trucker Tom's podcast, and we'd love to hear what you have to say. All you have to do is send us an email to tom@truckerphoto.com.